Tonight on Standing Room Only, the state of the American labor movement.
Welcome to Standing Room Only, featuring lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums recorded on location by WFHB community volunteers. This program amplifies voices not adequately represented in mainstream media to help raise public consciousness of issues affecting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
From May 31st to June 3rd, the Working Class Studies Association held their annual conference at Indiana University. Each day, there were several rounds of panels and speakers. On June 3rd, the closing plenary speaker, Kim Moody, spoke to the present and possible futures of labor movement in the U.S. He touched on many sides of the issue, including surveillance, organizing strategies, and resources. We begin with an introduction from Professor Joe Varga.
Kim was, correct me again, I'll later mention the director. By one of the founders of the journal Labor Notes and the director from 1979 to 2001. And I don't know about you, but I find Labor Notes indispensable for news about the labor movement in the United States. Yeah, definitely. And I think I've actually appeared in Labor Notes when I wrote an article about the Indiana limestone strike here in 2011, and it appeared in Labor Notes. Kim also taught at Cornell's Labor Studies program, taught at Brooklyn College, where I also taught, where Ken teaches, Brooklyn College. And has written numerous articles, too numerous to mention, recently appearing in Jacobin magazine. And of course has written how many books have you written? Do you even remember?
Five?
Okay. An Injury to All Workers in a Lean World, the In Solidarity book from 2014, and the latest one, the 2017, On New Terrain, How Capital is Reshaping the Battleground of Class War. So I will give you Ken Moody.
Okay. A little atmosphere here first. Well, thanks to the Working Class Studies Association for inviting me. All right, class struggle. This is not a theme of major conferences that you hear much, so congratulations for that. I want to look at it a little bit under the radar and also in the sunlight. I imagine some of you know who these folks are, right? Anybody tell me? No? Well, you got to read labor notes, like I said. What? No? Well, these are the truckeros. These are the truck drivers in the port of Los Angeles, Long Beach. They move things from the waterfront to the edge of the Inland Empire, which is a huge area of warehouses, etc. they are immigrants, for the most part. Latinos, and they are independent contractors. That's why this one is carrying a sign that says we are employees, because in reality, that's what they are. They work for capitalist companies, they take orders from them and so forth. So here they are picketing not too long ago, not to get union recognition yet, but to get status as an employee. So this is kind of part of what's going on, right? I'll get back to that. State of the US labor movement, that's what it says out there on the sign. This pretty much captures the well-known story of it in recent years. Declining membership, near disappearance of the strike, and so on. It is at a crisis point, as many people have pointed out. Nothing new here, unfortunately. The main culprits here are, of course, the bosses. Capital is the main culprit, and their politicians, who have gotten bolder and more right-wing and all the rest of it recently, in their attacks on unions. But, as I have often said before, the labor leadership in this country has to bear part of the responsibility. The whole practice and ideology of business unionism, although it changes somewhat from decade to decade, it's not quite as boldly awful as it was at one time. Nonetheless, these practices, which perhaps we can discuss more about, bear some responsibility for this. And I want to mention one in particular. And this has to do with our new president, Mr. Trump, and the alleged shift of white working class votes to him. I say alleged because, you know, a lot of the media exaggerate it, but it's real enough. We shouldn't try to deny that it happened. And what is the role of the labor leadership in this? Well, for 40 years, since the 1970s, American labor leaders in major manufacturing industries have been telling their members that the reason they're losing jobs, the reason they can't get these wage increases, the reason they have to line up with management is because of the foreigners, the imports, the offshoring. Now, I'm not saying these things don't happen. Of course they do, in some industries more than others. But what I am saying is that, and I will argue later if I have time, that in fact the imports and offshoring are not the major cause of lost manufacturing jobs. But nonetheless, that's what the American labor leadership, by and large, with some exceptions, have been telling their members for 40 years now. Well, along comes a politician and says, I'm going to take care of that. There's not going to be that kind of trade. There's not going to be any more offshoring. I'm going to go down to Indiana and show you how it's done and so forth. You know the story. So then they're shocked when their members respond, some of their members respond to a politician who makes this kind of promise. Well, they've been led to believe that's the source of the problem and have developed what I would call a kind of labor nationalism. Now, nationalism, racism, these things, they've always been around. It's not a new thing in itself, but it has a specific labor aspect to it, and that's basically, I think, part of the problem here, because it has led to things like labor management cooperation and so forth. But okay, let's put that aside. I'm not going to talk much more about that sort of traditional thing. I want to look at the under the radar labor movement. Now, who are these people? I bet you don't know who these people are. These are railroad workers. This is not somebody that is a favorite group of the left in general. But on May 3rd of this year, a couple of days after the big immigrant strike and demonstration and so forth, in their hundreds, not the thousands or tens of thousands, but in their hundreds, they demonstrated at a number of the nation's key railroad yards. They were demonstrating against the companies, the railroad companies' attempts to basically take away their medical coverage and other kinds of concessions. So they essentially invaded the railroad yards and held these demonstrations around the country. Well, why do I bring this bunch up? Because I think it's an interesting bunch, and because it will fit in with something I'm going to talk about a little later. Most of them came from the Brotherhood of Maintenance of Way Employees, which is a division now of the Teamsters Union. 40,000 members, unlike your image of the classic railroad brotherhood, it's a very racially and gender diverse union. These are the people who mend, repair, lay down the tracks of the railway system. And it's interesting that while the nation's infrastructure is famously falling apart, the railroad freight companies are investing billions in upgrading the major cross-country railroad corridors so that they can carry double-stacked containers on the freight trains. So these workers are important. They play a role in making that possible. This little union in the 90s had a reform movement, rank and file type movement, that took over not the whole union, but one of its major divisions. The members of the whole union voted by 3-2 for the reform candidate, the opposition candidate, in the Teamsters Union in the recent election there, as did, interestingly enough, the other rail union that is now in the Teamsters. This union, this brotherhood, a misnomer, because they do have significant women members, advocates single-payer health care, Medicare for all. It's becoming a more popular demand for obvious reasons. And they endorsed Bernie Sanders rather than Hillary Clinton in the primary last year. So it's not your usual railroad brotherhood, to be sure, but it's a key union in what is becoming, what I'm going to talk about a little later, the way things are made and moved in this country now. What was the coverage of this demonstration, or the ones across the country, even though there was some police violence in Chicago? The coverage was, as far as I could tell, zero. This does not exist. People can't know about it, including other railroad workers. Now, not everybody there was from the maintenance of way track repair people. Some of them came from others of the 13 railroad unions that represent railroad workers. And they were brought, to a large extent, by this group, Railroad Workers United. This is another under-the-radar type of organization. Their purpose is to bring together activists from the different railway unions to work against concessions for democracy, and in particular against the introduction of single worker, single employee crews on freight trains. That means, of course, the engineer would be the only, would be the crew. The trainman would be gone. The others that, I worked on the railroad once for a summer in 63, and we had a crew of four. No more. They were mostly gone. So, Railroad Workers United started in 2008 and meets every year and every other year, interestingly enough, just before the Labor Notes Conference. These kind of movements, I want to point out, have been on the rise. There are a kind of a regular historical feature of American labor. They come and go and tend to come in waves. There were a lot of them in the 60s and 70s, a few in the 80s, and now they seem to, in the last 10 years or so, to be back. Some of these I'm sure you know something about. I'm not going to go through all of them. Probably the one you know best is CORE, the Chicago Teachers Union Reform Group that changed that union dramatically and has actually helped create a national rank and file organization across both the teachers' unions. Some of them you may not have heard of are things like Rosie's Machinists. Now, what in the world is that? You can see the picture, you get the idea of the old poster from World War II, Rosie the Riveter. But these women, and men too, are contemporaries. They work for Boeing, and they were organized to try to fight against the concessions that the machinist union were making. They don't run candidates. They are an activist group at the workplace level, but they supported the reform slate in the machinists in the last election, which got about a third of the votes. TDU, Teamsters for a Democratic Union, this is pretty well known on the left at least. They don't run candidates either, but they do support candidates, in this case the slate called Teamsters United, which actually carried the U.S. vote against Hoffa Jr., but lost on the basis of the Canadian vote. They elected about six people to the International Executive Board. I'm not going to go through all of these, but the point is there are more of them. Now, to me, there are two things that make this significant. One is that they, to a greater extent, even than the ones in the 60s and 70s, with the exception of things like Drum, the Revolutionary Black Workers Movement, and so forth, they are challenging most of the norms and ideas of business unionism, in the sense that they are for union democracy, they're against concessions, they're for militancy, direct action, a greater attention to issues of diversity, and opposition to labor management cooperation, and so on. when they win, the pressures against them doing all those things are enormous, and so they don't always, they're not always able, or they don't always do all the things they promise. But nonetheless, they represent something like a challenge to the norms of American bureaucratic business unionism. The second thing that's important about them, though, is that these are a reflection of something much deeper. And that is the day-to-day class struggle that goes on, not only in unionized industries, but in more and more jobs everywhere. We all know, perhaps, about the average American shop steward who is drowning to death in casework, instead of leading mass strikes and things of that sort. Nonetheless, this kind of conflict goes on a day-to-day basis. Sometimes it emerges in the form of these kind of rank-and-file reform movements, most of which, again, are, unless you read Labor Notes or Union Democracy Review or some of the left press, are pretty much under the radar. Well, here we are in the sunlight, something relatively new. This is February 16th in Milwaukee, 30,000 marched. And of course, this was all over the country. might think of this as spontaneous, but I'll come back to that in a minute. Whoops, wrong button. This is actually the wrong picture, but I'm talking here about March 8th, the Day Without a Woman, the women's strike. And then, of course, May 1st. Day Without Immigrants, the second one from 2006, and so on. These things, of course, do get publicity because they're massive. But one of the important things to realize about these movements is that, much like these rank-and-file movements in the unions, beneath the surface of these massive events has been, for the last 10 or 20 years, a lot of organizing by groups that you don't read about in the paper as a rule. Workers' centers, a lot of them are called workers' centers. There's a couple of hundred of them across the country. they're important. There are some sort of union-sponsored things like Restaurant Opportunities Coalition. there's something new, or relatively new, called cosecha, which means harvest, but this is another kind of grassroots movement that seems to have, or at least claims to have, been behind much of the this year's immigrant activity. And they're very clear that they advocate the strike as the way forward. So what I'm saying is that, for the most part, we need to, when we think about these big things that happen, we need to realize that they didn't come out of nowhere. There is a lot of spontaneity involved in this, don't get me wrong, but there are also people who have been on the ground in the immigrant neighborhoods and communities, organizing locally and sometimes nationally. So that's under the radar, but sometimes it comes out. Then there is the fight for 15. There seems to be a debate over whether this actually involves strikes or not, and I can't really give you the answer to that. Perhaps people here have an opinion. But it's certainly something new. This is union-backed. It's not spontaneous in that sense, but I think it's nonetheless important. There have been some similar things going on in warehousing and retail and elsewhere. A couple of points on this that we learn from what I've been talking about and other things I haven't been able to talk about. That is that the labor movement is more than unions. I think in this country, more than anywhere else in the world, when we say labor movement, what we mean is the AFL-CIO plus whatever else, you know, official unions, the institutions. But second point here is that unions are more than the institutions that we see. They're more than collective bargaining. They're more than their leadership, their finances, their offices, and all of that. The way these things are usually reported in the daily press and so forth when they are reported. The other thing, and I think this is important, and this is new, the strike didn't die. It seems to have died in the collective bargaining arenas, but here we have tens of thousands of people, if not more, striking for immigrants' rights, gender equality, whatever, these $15 minimum wage and so forth. It hasn't been since May 1st, 1886, that the strike has been used for broad social goals. That was the 8-hour strike at that time. There have been local general strikes, there have been all kinds of stuff in American labor history, as you know, but the use of the mass strike for a political social goal beyond collective bargaining is actually something new in our lifetime. And here it is again. Part of the question is, well, why is this happening now? There are a lot of reasons. What do all these workers I've talked about, okay, our railroad workers, our rank and file activists, the reformers, workplace activists and so forth, the immigrant workers, the women workers, what is there something, some things they have shared in the last few years? There have been some workshops. I just went to one here about downward mobility. That kind of captures it pretty well. But I think there are some specific things. Lean production. This is old news, but it's important because it starts in the car industry, the auto industry, in the 80s in this country. Now it's everywhere. You see Six Sigma in hospitals. You can name it, total quality management. These programs have been around since the 80s. They're not new. But here is an example. This is from manufacturing. That in this 10-year period, 99 to 2009, the amount of time it took for workers to reproduce their own total compensation during a workday was cut by half. Now, this tells you a lot about the speed up, not just speed up, but filling the pores. This is also old. The famous Toyota 57-second minute as opposed to the American 45-second minute of work. This is the amount of time you're actually in motion doing something for each minute. It's a goal. Most places can't hope to achieve anything quite this drastic, but nonetheless it tells you something about the importance of time, and I'm going to come back to that. And here's something that isn't just manufacturing. This is across the U.S. workforce. A study that was done of time use journals, 43,000 of them, discovered that the amount of break time that the average American worker, whether service or manufacturing, whatever, has fallen from 13% of the day, assuming an 8-hour day, on average to 8%. Now, think of what that means to the bosses, to capital. You don't get paid anymore for, you know, working this extra time, whether it's the 57-second minute or this, but the boss gets more, gets a bigger share of your work. You're still getting paid by the hour. You get paid for your 8 hours or 10 hours or whatever it is, or 4 hours. But the boss is getting a great deal more. And I would argue that this is one of the things that is at the root of the enormous inequality that we've had. But there's something else, and that is this whole question of time. Time has always been important to capitalists, but it has become more important. and as a way to make extra money. In an era when the system has been slowing down, and everybody's sort of noticed this, every decade for the last several decades, the things seem to be getting a little worse, the economy grows at a somewhat slower rate, and so on. It's not a continuous thing, there are plenty of ups and downs, but the trend seems fairly clear. And then, of course, you all know about just-in-time. This is also goes back to the 80s, but it's now, it's everywhere. And it's extremely important to employers in terms of their competition with one another and with foreign competitors as well. But as I say, lean production is old news. Here's the newer news. I would say the last 20 years, this kind of surveillance. 80% of American workers now are monitored either electronically or biometrically. and when I say monitored, we're not talking about minutes or seconds. We're talking about things, measurements that are even deeper than that. Just look at some of these are the relatively new. Some of them are older than others. I'm not going to go through each of these. You know, if people want to ask questions about it, they can. the most astounding one that I know of are the UPS drivers, the van drivers, the delivery drivers. When they sit in their van, they are monitored for 200 functions, biometrically, electronically, et cetera, et cetera. And not just while they're sitting there, but as they do their rounds and make their deliveries and so on. And this is now universal. Anybody who works in a truck or a van or anything like that is now subject to GPS so that your employers know where you are at all times. I used to work at the New York Telephone Company way back when. And the first thing we did every morning was our group. Our vans would converge on a neighborhood diner, and we would spend an hour having breakfast at the company's expense. Now, all those vans have GPS, and there ain't no breakfast anymore, needless to say. So the result of all of this has been a pretty continuous increase in productivity, and of course, as we know, flat wages and compensation. Now, let me just digress for a second to say one thing about this, and that is that let's get back to this thing about imports. Now, again, I'm not saying that imports don't affect a number of industries. We know the garment, textiles, small electronics, and so forth. Steel to some extent, although an exaggerated extent, I would argue. one of the pieces of evidence that it can't be just imports is that American manufacturing output has gone up enormously at speeds that are almost comparable, not quite, but almost comparable to the 50s and 60s when everything was hunky-dory, right? so that the average American worker is making four times the value of goods that he or she did in the 1950s, and twice what he or she produced in the early 1980s.
You have been listening to The State of the American Labor Movement on Standing Room Only on WFHB. You've been listening to Kim Moody, one of the founders of Labor Notes, discuss factors affecting the state of labor movement in the U.S. His talk was the closing plenary address for the Working Class Studies Association conference, which was held in early June at Indiana University. We now return to the show, with Kim Moody speaking about the types of jobs available in the U.S. today.
So, across the class, the end of good jobs is nigh. This affects not only working class people, upwardly mobile, downwardly mobile, staying working class. This is from the last panel I was listening to. we know, of course, that these impacts are unequal within the working class on race and gender basis and so forth. But the fact is that now there is enough misery to go around. And so everybody, almost everybody, below managerial and professional categories, and I would include, in fact, many professional categories, are experiencing work that is worse, loss of any kind of autonomy, falling wages, declining benefits, the lost social safety net. And that, to me, one of the more interesting figures from the BLS is that if you look at non-managerial and non-professional job projections from 2014 to 2024, 70% of them are in low-wage, low-skill categories. 70%. and of course, there's more precarious work, like our traqueros that we saw in the beginning. But there's also another change, and this is actually the thing that I want to focus on, even though I'm taking too much time, because I think it's what has changed, the title of this book that I've written that will be out in December, On New Terrain, refers to these changes. There's actually more of them that I'm going to talk about. And that is the way that goods in this society are moved. I call this the global supply chain gang situation, where now on a just-in-time basis, supply chains in almost any industry you can name, we're talking first about production, have been reduced. Remember all the outsourcing back in the 80s and 90s and so forth? The mid-90s, reverse. Get rid of too many suppliers, create tiers, make them responsible for the lower tiers, et cetera, et cetera. The thing that's important about this and these changes in supply chain management and the time, the importance of time in all of this, is that it affects everything in the economy. Supply chains are not just something that goes from producer to producer or producer to retailer, say to Walmart or something like that. They go to everything. They go to hotels, hospitals, universities, you name it. You can't do anything without these things that you depend on, all this stuff here. Somebody made these things. Somebody had to bring them here, install them, etc. So supply chains are a universal aspect of any capitalist economy, and today they are much tighter than they ever were in the past. And of course, they are vulnerable. This is famous. Everybody's known this for a long time. If you have a tight supply chain on a just-in-time basis, somebody strikes at one node of the chain, as they call it, and the whole thing can come down. It doesn't get used much. Here's an unusual example of it. This is the Verizon strike. We don't think of telecom workers as part of a supply chain, do we? But they are. They're fundamental to the internet. They're fundamental to business operations. In this particular case, one of the reasons they won the strike, remember that telecom workers, whether wired or wireless, are working in an industry that is almost totally automated. We talk about, oh, automation's going to come and it's going to do all this stuff and everything. Well, it did that there a long time ago, and it's even more so today. So you think, well, they're going to go out and strike. They haven't got a prayer. Wrong. Because they are supplying industry with something it wanted, which just, in this case, happens to be some new fiber optic supplies and services that they have to get from a telecom company. So when the Verizon workers went on strike, industry, the companies, business, couldn't get these new fiber optic things that they needed to compete with all the people who already had them. So they started turning to other telecom companies. And Verizon finally, you know, had to say, well, okay, we'll give you these jobs that you want and so forth. All right, new sites of struggle. We all remember the auto plants of Detroit, the steel mills of Gary, et cetera, Pittsburgh and Youngstown and all of this. They're not all gone, but mostly they are. They've been replaced not so much by foreign steel as by domestic mini mills. I'd argue that. I can pull some figures out if you want. These are three kinds of things. This is obviously, top one is obviously a port. They're important. There are ports in places you wouldn't think there are ports. That's something to keep in mind too. You may know this, but you know, Chicago, for example, is a port. It's not just a rail center or a truck center, it's a port. Memphis is a port. ports now often refer not just to ships, but of course to airplanes. And with the rise of next day delivery and all this e-commerce stuff and everything, all these companies that move things have turned increasingly to the use of air travel, air traffic rather. These are the factories of today. They're warehouses. But they're not yesterday's warehouses. They don't store much anymore. Some of them do, of course. But mostly the idea is to move things through them as fast as possible. Cross-docking. You bring a truck into one door. You move the thing across the thing. Maybe you do a fiddle with a product a little bit. and it's out the other side of the place. This, of course, is the inside of what a modern warehouse looks like. These things are new. This is not 20 years old, for the most part. And that's an important thing to keep in mind when I get closer to the conclusion. Now, here, to me, is the clincher that capital has made a big mistake, once again. They knew to get rid of these concentrations of industrial workers. Let's close down Gary and Detroit and Akron, et cetera, move everything, you know, to little towns in the Midwest or to the South or even abroad. the problem is when you disperse production like that, you have to move things from one place to another more. Well, how are you going to do that? Well, it takes trucks and planes and trains and boats, and they don't move any faster than they did 30 years ago. Some of them carry more than they used to, but the speed is about the same. So you have to have a system that moves all of this as fast as possible. So they adopted, quite naturally, the traditional airline thing of the hub and spoke system. And what that has created in the last, again, this isn't even 20 years old for the most part, are what are being called now logistics clusters. These are huge concentrations of workers in relatively small geographic areas that are adjacent to major cities. I'll explain why that has to be not a matter of choice. There are 60 of them, more or less, in the US. Altogether, they are said to employ pretty much directly 3.5 million people, mostly blue-collar workers. But that doesn't count all the people who move in and out of them, all the UPS drivers, all the truckers, all the rail workers, et cetera, et cetera. including our track repair people who have to come in and lay a new track into one of these, well, one of those warehouses that was the last picture. So we're looking at something, the one around Chicago is said to have 150 to 200,000 people concentrated in a couple of counties on the edge of Chicago. New York, New Jersey, and Los Angeles, perhaps 100,000, maybe a little more by now. Memphis, the big newcomer here, FedEx Center, is said to have, not all employed by FedEx by any means, but including everything, over 200,000 workers concentrated in a relatively small space. Louisville, the UPS world port, one could go on. What I want to argue is that these are today's Detroit's, Gary's, and Pittsburgh. The warehouses are the factories. These are the big concentrations. The point of this is that these are places where our railroad workers, our troqueros, our Teamster dissidents, et cetera, we could go through it, our Verizon workers or telecom workers, these are places where they all meet on a day-to-day basis often. I don't mean that they personally know each other. You know, a truck drives up to a warehouse and somebody unloads it and everybody, but there is the potential there for contact. All these kinds of workers are brought together in these huge concentrations of essentially semi-skilled blue-collar labor. Racially diverse, the big clusters like New York, Chicago, and LA. Chicago is majority African American, LA and New York, New Jersey, mostly Latino and immigrant. On average in the warehouses, women are about 25% of the workforce. So it's a diverse workforce. And then you have the older things like the truck drivers and the rail workers who are predominantly probably white and better paid and unionized, coming together in this. What I'm saying here is I'm not predicting that, this is the something that's going to happen immediately or something like that. But what I am saying is that if labor is looking for a strategy to change things, here's the place to look. Now, I'm not the first one to say this, and I think there are lots of labor leaders and labor activists who know about this. You go to a Labor Notes conference, you'll see all these people are there. You know, they're interacting. so the potential is there. Furthermore, in most of the, or at least the biggest of these clusters, as they're called, logistics clusters, there are organizing things going on, but they're not traditional union ones. They're not going through the NLRB. They're not doing that sort of fruitless thing that goes on forever and doesn't always work out so well. They're taking a different approach. Some of them are workers' centers. Some of them are union-backed, some not. So what I'm really saying here is that we have to look at this if we're going to do research into working class life. This might be something that we need more of. I've done some. I'm going to do a lot more. And I think other people should. There are all kinds of dimensions to look at, race and gender, different levels of income, unionized, non-unionized. What are the workers' centers doing? How do they react with the unions? Do they react with the unions? You know, these are important questions. But I think this is a potential starting point for a new upsurge. I say starting point because obviously this is not the whole working class, or even the whole of organized labor. But think about how it happened in the 30s and at previous times. You had people like the Teamsters, okay, the famous Minneapolis Teamsters. You know, they organized in that city. They built a power base there. They went out along the roads and organized truckers and warehouse workers along those paths. Well, we have these paths because all of these clusters are tied together by what they're called corridors, is the term they mostly use. We call them highways or rail lines or things of that sort, the internet system, interstate system, I mean, sorry. And so if there can be this kind of thing, I think that's one way that we could see a revival of organized labor. Again, I'm not predicting anything. I gave up predicting things a long time ago after being wrong a great many times, like many on the left. But I think it's important to understand that these things don't come out of nowhere. If we can't predict them, they don't come out of nowhere. They come out of the conditions, they come out of experience like previous upsurges. And I cite Eric Hobsbawm because I particularly like the way he put it. A lot of people have said this, that labor does not grow, the working class organizations do not grow, you know, little by little, simply organizing, you know, a couple of hundred people here and there and all the rest of it. When there is growth, like in the 30s and earlier periods, or the public employees in the 60s and 70s and so forth, they tend to come as sort of explosions, as upsurges. And they don't come out of nowhere. And I like the way he put it about kind of the accumulations of inflammable materials which only ignite periodically as it were under compression. Well, if we look at what's happening to the workforce in this country and the working class generally, if that isn't compression, I don't know what is. I'll conclude on one last point. Upsurges are the result of what we might call a learning curve. Capital changes the way it produces goods and services all the time. We don't necessarily see it. It might look the same for 10 or 20 years, you know, and so forth. But basically, they're always changing the way things are made, the way things, services are produced, the interactions, the way things are moved, all the rest of it. And when that happens, it takes time for the workers involved in these changing industries and occupations to figure out the weak points, the points of pressure that they can apply to employers, to management, and so forth. So for example, if you think of the upsurge of the 30s, I'll just use that, this was essentially the working class learning to deal with something that had happened 20 years or more before, namely mass production, Taylorism, and the giant corporation. When these things first came along, they were incredibly disorienting. And attempts, for example, to organize steel and meatpacking after the First World War didn't work out, partly because of racial things and the stupidity of craft union leaders, but also because the workers hadn't kind of figured out how to get together and how to deal with these new ways of working, these new ways of capital organization and the rest of it. The same thing could be said about the upsurge of the 60s and 70s, the sort of rank and file upsurge of that period. This was a response to essentially a new managerial efforts that began after World War II in the form of speed up, but also of moving production out of places like Detroit. This began long before the 70s and 80s, began in the 40s, right after the war, some of it even during the war, moving things out, and it was disorienting to people. So it takes a while to learn. So my concluding point is this. Upsurges are not something you wait for. Upsurges are something you look for. Upsurges are something you organize for. And that's my message. I think there are possibilities out there that labor is not taking up yet, even though some people have these ideas too, that that's what we need to do to paraphrase the old Wobbly, don't wait, organize. Thank you. Yes.
Surveillance isn't a one-way street. Workers have agency to also use surveillance on their employers, and we know that employers break laws at multiple levels, environmental laws, labor laws, and workers can use surveillance of their employers to organize as well. What do you suggest?
Yeah, that's a very good point.
There's also the point in which surveillance can become futile if you produce so much information that there's no point in surveilling anymore. In my experience, activism, the information we produced was so public that there was no interest in surveillance anymore. So, different.
Great. Good point. Yes.
Yeah, thanks for the great talk. I wanted to ask a kind of resource mobilization question. About 3 years ago, there was a campaign up in Elgin, which is one of the clusters outside of Chicago. It's a warehouse cluster. It's amazing, right? Just and miles and miles of warehouses. Yeah. And anyway, it was the laborers actually who started this. They were organizing a campaign with warehouse workers who did not work for Walmart, right? But they were mostly temps doing Walmart work in these warehouses. And it was mostly about the working conditions, the freezing working conditions. And they made, we actually sent two carloads of people up there, and they blocked the entrance to this warehouse. They had local clergy. But it was the enormous amount of effort that they put in just to do that. And they had no real way to organize these people into dues-paying members. Yet they, and we're seeing this happening a lot with Fight for 15. They're you know, spending this enormous amount of financial resources and not getting a lot of return. And then there was burnout, and this campaign just died. After this one successful effort, they got a little bit of change in the climatic conditions inside the warehouse. But after that, there was no follow-up. I even contacted them again. Are we going to do this more? Are we going to shut down the highway around Elgin? And how do we sustain that without getting the dues coming in? And the, like, who's going to back this is my question, like, in your opinion.
Actually, what my opinion is that this is our problem, that, we are so accustomed to requiring these kind of resources that, you know, we, I mean all of us who are involved in one way or another in, you know, and around the labor movement in the broad sense, not just the unions, but particularly the unions, everything is a cost-benefit analysis, right? And because they're institutions, in a certain sense, they have no choice. So if we rely simply on how many organizers can the laborers or the UE, which is working in the Chicago warehouses too, how many organizers can that tiny union put into the field? You know, well, the answer is not much. So going back to what I was talking about, upsurges and learning curves, is that ultimately, if you look at the CIO, you know, we read a lot of the books, and then John L. Lewis did this, and then Murray did that, and so forth. One of the greatest things I remember reading, I don't remember which book it was, but the organizer from the Steelworkers Organizing Committee goes into a big mill, I think it was in Gary, I'm not sure, and he said, the union was there before the union got there. In other words, the workers began organizing themselves, workers' self-activity. And ultimately, it always depends on that. It can't be done just in an institutional fashion. And that's what I mean, again, about the learning curve. People figuring out how dependent these people, these employers are, you know, whether they're warehouse employers or temp employers or trucking employers, et cetera, how dependent they are on this labor and how vulnerable these just-in-time supply chains and these huge clusters or pieces of these huge clusters are. It takes a while to learn that. It takes the development of a what you might call the activist layer or what the syndicalists used to call the militant minority. And it always takes that. And part of our weakness in the labor movement here, and not just here, by the way, is the weakness of that layer. You know, the old layers did it in the 30s. They were full of Reds, old wobbly veterans, communists, Trotskyists, you name it, you know, who had organizing experience. We don't have that so much anymore. So people are going to have to learn on their own. The unions can play a role in that, not by substituting themselves for everything, but by doing some decent education, you know, around that doesn't involve labor management cooperation, that doesn't say it's the foreigners, that doesn't, you know, say a lot of the things. I'm not saying that all union leaders are doing that in terms of immigration, quite the opposite almost, because they're desperate for members, and here are millions of people, some of whom want to be organized and so forth. But nonetheless, I think it is partly a question of the development of this kind of layer among the workers themselves. And the conditions play a role in that. They're not necessarily enough to do it by itself. But I think that's sort of what we have to depend on in the end. And that's it. Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to Kim Moody, one of the founders of Labor Notes, discuss factors affecting the state of labor movement in the U.S. His talk was the closing plenary address for the Working Class Studies Association conference, which was held in early June at Indiana University.
You've been listening to Standing Room Only. Join us each week for on-location recordings of lectures, town hall meetings, and other public forums. If there's a particular event you'd like to hear broadcast on this program, email that information to us directly at news@wfhb.org. The Standing Room Only archive is available online at wfhb.org/news. Standing Room Only is a production of our volunteer-powered news and public affairs department here on Community Radio, WFHB.